Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Dr. Rustin Moore is the Rita Jean Wolf Endowed Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, who has written this book, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions. And Dr. Moore, what a pleasure to have you on the radio. This is the first time we've talked on the radio together. Is this your first book especially for the average pet parent?
Well, first, Steve, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to talk with you. And I've written a lot of academic books and papers, but this is really my first book that is meant for the general audience, really for about anyone, and certainly the first book related to this topic of the human-animal bond for me.
And I want to talk about what the human-animal bond is, but you write in the book that it all began for you growing up on a farm, and it wasn't necessarily about dogs and cats.
Correct. I grew up on a small, what I call hobby farm in the Appalachian Hills of West Virginia, where my parents had a few acres, and I was the one that had the animals. So that's the hobby part of it. But I had cattle, and I had a pig, and I had ponies and horses and ducks and chickens and cats and dogs and rabbits and a whole lot more.
And eventually you had a whole lot more in the way of dogs and cats, and I want to talk about that. But I want to ask you the question that people, even before you wrote the book, probably would stop you on the street and say, what is this human-animal bond anyway? What is it? And it's a hard thing to describe, and you take a stab at it in the book.
Yeah, I think, most people think the human-animal bond is this warm and fuzzy interaction, and it really goes beyond that. There's really biological, physiological, biochemical explanations for it. And what that means is, for example, if we look into the eyes of our dog, or we pet our dog or cat, or the cat's laying on our lap and purring, our body is releasing chemicals. And those chemicals are really bonding hormones, or love hormones, or feel-good hormones, like oxytocin, dopamine, and serotonin. It lowers our blood pressure. It lowers our heart rate. It can lower cholesterol and other things, just the bond itself. And some of those same things happen in the bodies of the pets or animals that we're interacting with. It also decreases our stress hormone, cortisol.
Yes, which may be going up your stress hormone right now because the dog is barking in the background, or the dogs. Are those still miniature schnauzers you have?
Yes, and I think he's talking to you.
I've done more than one interview with a miniature schnauzer, so that's perfectly fine by me. So, even, and this is the way I've put it, I think that we're hardwired, and you write a little about this, and it's the reason why pet store sales are what they are sometimes, even though in my view, I'm not sure dogs should be sold at pet stores. In fact, I'm sure they should not be because of where they're sourced from. But the success happens because you're walking down the street and you look into the window and you see those big eyes look back at you and that big forehead look at you as well of that puppy, no matter what kind of dog it is. Are we kind of hardwired to say and have bred dogs to appeal to us, if you will?
Yeah, Steve, I think there's certainly a lot to that. I mean, if we go back all the way, 15,000 years ago when dogs started becoming domesticated from wolves, we have, through selection, artificial selection or natural selection, we've decided what we want, we breed for it, and that's why we have so many different variations of dogs. And a lot of that is bred for certain behaviors, and some of it's bred for certain looks. And so I absolutely think that as dogs have evolved over centuries, we have played a major role in shaping what they look like and what kind of activities that they perform.
The term I was struggling and couldn't think of is neoteny, is the term for it, of intentionally breeding dogs to appeal to us in a way that we can't help. But it does go back for thousands of years, as you point out. And you write in the book, for example, that we domesticated horses. We have a bond with horses. We couldn't do that very well with zebras. There are certain species where it did work. And dogs, I think, are the only example ever on the planet where two predatory species, we're the other one, actually work together in a symbiotic way to benefit each species. Thousands of years ago, I'm talking about Cro-Magnon men and women who did this and saw something in dogs, or maybe they saw it in us, and they weren't even quite dogs yet. They were a species of wolf at the very beginning that's now long gone. And now, all these years later, we still have a very special relationship. You write about a lot of other animals, and we'll talk about other animals, but it's dogs, I think, that we're almost hardwired. I don't know. What do you think? I think we're hardwired to understand them. And in fact, I think the reverse is even more true. I think they understand us even better than we understand them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think there's the concept of the human-animal bond is universal, but it's not exact, or it's not unique. It's unique to each animal and each person, even within dogs. But I certainly agree with you that, you know, in the beginning, and even today, I think we see that in the beginning, when wolves were being domesticated, there was that symbiotic relationship of, and they, you know, they sought out the scraps of meat and things that were thrown out by the people, and then they started, you know, noticing and started, some of the wolves were more tame, particularly if there was an orphan pup that they raised. And so I think that complementary and, you know, mutual needs of each other. And I think we see that today. I mean, if you know, dogs are very clingy, I mean, for the most part with their owner, and work together, whether it's in sporting activities or hunting or you name it. And we don't see that in other domesticated species. Yes, they're tame. Yes, they interact. We lead them in shows and things like that, but it's not the same kind of bond. Cats probably closer than many others, but not, again, not the same.
When you first began doing all of what you do in veterinary medicine, I suspect that you called your patients pets. Today, they're called fur babies very often. And I wonder if that is a good thing or not. Have we actually gone too far in some ways? You write about that in the book, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of the Human-Animal Interaction. We're talking with, from the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, Dean Rustin Moore, and we'll be right back on WGN. Steve Dale back with you on WGN Radio. The book is called Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions. And boy, power is probably the right word, Dean Rustin Moore, because it is powerful. Has it become too powerful in some ways?
Thanks, Steve. Great question. And it is something that I address in the book. And I think it can become too powerful, or it can be taken too far. I talk in the first section of the book about humanization of pets. And that's been going on for some time. We sort of talk about it from the backyard to the bedroom. And that alone, I don't personally think has taken it too far. We're buying them toys and clothes and stuff. Now, if they don't like it, that's not good. But I do think it can be taken to the extreme where, you know, we're taking a dog with us somewhere where it really doesn't want to be. Like, do we really want to take our dog, say, to the July 4th fireworks? That's probably not a good idea.
No!
It can be taken even to the darker side where the bond can be used to threaten someone or control someone, like a woman or family member who's experienced domestic violence, and the perpetrator uses that bond between those two to threaten and keep that person in control. Someone who hoards animals, that there's a mental health issue there, but also the bond is so strong, yet they can't actually take care of all the animals that they collect. So there are, I think there's a there's a spectrum of things and severities of when the bond is taken too far.
Are we at a crossroads, sort of? So on one hand, the city that I live in, Chicago, here where WGN Radio is located, and may I say where the American Veterinary Medical Association, just outside Chicago, is located, is considering doing what they've done in European countries, or at least many of those European countries, for hundreds of years, and that's allowing dogs into, for example, restaurants. On the other, you have all of these sort of going the opposite direction, other things that are happening as well. Do you think we're at a point, for example, housing? So landlords and HOAs are saying increasingly in some places, you've got to pay more money to have that pet there, forcing people in some cases to give up their pet who don't have the money to pay for it. So are we at a interesting point in time, or maybe that's exactly why you wrote the book right now?
Well, it is, because one of the reasons I wrote the book is to have some calls to action. One, to raise awareness, and then to have people have calls to action. So, yes, I think we are sort of in this dichotomy or this paradox or whatever we might say, where some parts of the bond or the relationship is evolving and growing. And housing is a great example where that's an inequity. And landlords, you know, they might think that a dog does more damage, but actually, I would say, in many times, children do more.
yes.
And we don't charge for children. And then we say, well, if it's over 45 pounds or over a certain amount, then we're going to charge more. I actually think that's going to change. I think if you look at some of the work from the that's been done by a number of people, but also supported by the Human Animal Bond Research Institute, I think we're going to start seeing that. In fact, right here in Columbus, I think they're going to start offering act incentives for people who are building housing, like apartments, et cetera, to actually allow them to be pet inclusive or pet friendly. So I think we are going to start seeing that. I think the public is going to demand it, and that's what drives people, businesses, to do certain things, is what the public wants. So yes, I think we're at a place that we're going to see that change, I think.
I think that's absolutely true, and the concern I have, though, is charging too much money that some people simply can't afford for the luxury. It should not be a luxury, in my view, anyway. It should be a right to have all family members, unless you've done something wrong. But you know what? If you've done something wrong, there are, for homeowners associations or in your lease, if you're a renter, there are rules anyway. So if you, for example, play your music too loud at 4 a.m, there are rules against that no matter where you happen to live, if you live in an apartment or condo association. The same thing should be true if you don't clean up after your dog. There should be rules. And those rules should be enforced. But there are more advantages than disadvantages. And right now, at this point in time, Dr. Moore, it turns out that, again, the timing of your book is just right here, because we have more pets in America and throughout much of the world, actually, than we've ever had before. Also, more multi-pet homes and more homes with a combination of dogs and cats, which makes me say, or at least get angry at people who say they fight like cats and dogs, because they really don't, I don't believe.
Right. No, I agree with you. I don't think it's right either that you should charge people for these pets. I mean, you know, it should be in there that if they damage it, they would have to pay for it, perhaps. But if they don't damage it, why are you paying more for it? And actually, I think having a pet should be a universal right, unless, again, they've done something. And I'm talking, you know, I'm not talking about not picking up after their dog, but if there was some abuse or whatever in the past, you know, they shouldn't be able to have one. But whether you're homeless or whether you, you know, live in a luxury home or whether you live wherever you live, you should have the right to have a pet. And and benefit from that human-animal bond. And so I completely agree with you.
Well, in fact, you write in your book that for property owners, embracing pet-inclusive policies offers lots of benefits. 83% of property managers report that pet-friendly units fill up faster, and about 80% find them easier to rent, with 92% of renters and 93% of property managers agreeing that pets are family. It's clear people want to move wherever they move with their pets, and hopefully, Dr. Moore, we are moving in that direction.
I hope so, and I think certain cities, certain ordinances, whatever, are moving in that direction more quickly than others. But again, I believe it will be related to public demand.
I think you're right about that. Unleashing the bond, harnessing the power of human-animal interactions. That bond, though, it's more about than just dogs and cats. We haven't talked enough about cats. We never do. So I want to talk more about cats. I want to talk about other animals, which we have a relationship as well with. And I have some interesting data you might not even know about, but you'll hear about it when we come back on WGN. It's a fact. Cats are overall living longer than ever before for a lot of reasons, increasing veterinary care as more people bring their cats to the vet, and veterinarians can do more than they could 10 or 15 years ago or more and know more about cat health. Cats improve nutrition. They're all factors. Maybe the biggest factor of all is that we're keeping our cats indoors more than ever before. But for all these reasons, cats are living longer. And according to a new BBC report, experts at the University of Edinburgh carried out a post-mortem brain exam on 25 cats. And what they learned, because all these 25 cats, by the way, had signs of dementia. So what they learned is that, yes, all of these cats have shown, same as dogs and same as people with dementia, a buildup in amyloid beta or amyloid plaque, which is a defining feature of Alzheimer's disease. Images of older cats, which had previously shown symptoms of feline dementia, revealed this buildup of amyloid plaque. And what that does is it interferes with the messages that are communicated between brain cells. Same thing we know as in dogs. Dogs age in strikingly similar ways to people. And for years now, dogs have been used as a model to better understand natural aging in all of us. After all, it's easier to study dogs, mostly because they age so much faster. Of course, humans take maybe, 75 years, 80 years before we become old enough to typically suffer from what is called Alzheimer's disease. Dogs experience aging much more quickly, of course, and a dog can be very old, anywhere depending on the breed or size of dog, between the age of 7 to 15 years, but that's way different than 75 or 80 years. The feline study confirms what researchers have assumed for some time, and now we know it. Not only is there a so-called One Health discovery regarding cats that's going to help cats, but we can now better understand how they age. And potentially, that can help people as well. So what are the signs of dementia in cats? Somewhat similar to dogs in many ways. So it is general confusion. A cat like walking into a room and wondering, what am I doing in that room? It is missing the litter box very often, even though the cat knows where the litter box is and doesn't, and there's no other medical explanation for it. A big one is yowling for no apparent reason in the middle of the night. And there are others as well. You can read more about it on my website, and that's stevedale.tv. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN. Steve Dale back with you on WGN Radio, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions. Dr. Rustin Moore is the author of that book. Dr. Moore, who I see at veterinary events frequently because he is the Rita Jean Wolf Endowed Dean, very fancy, of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Did I say that right, Dr. Moore?
You said it good enough. Yes.
Good enough is in that. So I don't get an A from Dr. Moore. I get, a B minus maybe?
No, I'll give you an A minus.
An A minus. Uh-oh. I've got to do better. I've got to figure out how to do better. All right. The human-animal bond is what you write about, and it is more than just about dogs and cats. And as an example, what I did was look up the greatest entertainment venue that people attend or go to worldwide. And one might think it is football or what we call soccer in America. That's actually way down as number two, but nowhere near the numbers that go to zoos all over the world. People, to my knowledge, don't force people, whether they be in Singapore, whether they be in Brazil, or whether they be in Ohio, to go to the Columbus Zoo. No one forces families to do that, but people do it. Is that an example of the human-animal bond?
It's a great question, Stephen. Personally, I believe it is. I mean, if you know, we have this natural inclination or attraction to nature. Biophilia is the term.
Yeah.
And I, you know, people enjoy being out in nature, whether it's in the woods or, in this case, at one of those zoos, including our Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. And I believe that there is a bond there. And actually, I have a second book coming out, and another one, where I delve deeper into that around wildlife or zoos, zoo animals. And so the bond, let's say at a zoo, there's a really strong bond between the zookeeper, the one who is taking care of that particular zoo animal, and that animal. And it's built through trust. Those people have spent enough time and rewarded them, the animals, in a positive way, where that animal will come up and, you know, and when it's time to have its exam from a veterinarian or have blood drawn on an annual basis, they do that with, and there's little stress associated with it. So that bond is built through trust, and that's what most bonds are built through. And so I think the public has the general bond or attraction to animals and nature. And, you know, the bond isn't going to be as strong necessarily between a zoo goer and an animal there as it would be with the zookeeper. But nonetheless, there are bonds there.
I want to talk a little about animal assisted therapy, which you write about in the book. So whether it be, typically it's a dog, but not necessarily. It doesn't have to be. Pet Partners certifies more animals, which I served on their scientific advisory board for quite a while, than any other organization by far. And yes, they certify more dogs than they do any other species, but there are other species as well. And why do you think it is that, I'll use dogs as an example, but it could, again, be another species. So it could be a rabbit, it could be a cat, could be a miniature horse, goes into a facility, let's say an Alzheimer's facility, and someone who has not opened up, if you will, had a quote-unquote typical or normal conversation in some time, doesn't recognize family members, somehow awakens, at least to some extent, with that miniature horse in front of that person or with that dog, even a person who's never even had a miniature horse in their lifetime or a dog in their own lifetime. It's a tough question to answer, I know, and you do write about it and address it in your book, Unleashing the Bond.
Yeah, I'll give you, I don't know that I can explain it. I mean, people with various levels of cognitive ability, or whether it's, you know, someone who's had a brain trauma, or whether it's someone with autism, or whether it's someone with dementia or whatever. So I don't know that I can explain some of it, but let me give you a couple quick examples, and I'm going to use the example of a pony. After Hurricane Katrina, there was a pony that got stranded, it got rescued, it got attacked by a dog a couple months later, ended up losing its right front leg. We fit it with a prosthesis. It lived for about another 12 years and traveled all over to children's hospitals, cancer camps, et cetera. And there was a young African-American boy at the New Orleans Children's Hospital who had, much like you said, he'd really not been responsive in terms of interacting or engaging. And when that pony first walked up, Molly's the pony's name, walked up to that boy, He smiled. You could tell he was engaging. And then that same pony, a couple years later, came up here to Ohio and up at the Amherst, in Amherst, Ohio, at Golden Acres, which was an elder care facility. There was a gentleman in a wheelchair who had one of his legs was amputated, just like the ponies. And he was off to the side and really wasn't engaging like all the other people. And so we walked the pony over, and he smiled when that pony got to him. He reached up with both hands on the two sides of her halter. He pulled himself up and kissed her on the nose. And I can't explain why that happens, but it happens time and time and time again.
Yeah, indeed it does. And I've had the honor of doing animal-assisted therapy for many, many years. And you see, sometimes, if you're very lucky, something like you describe, which is a miracle. I'm not sure what word to use or words. But even if the family feels a little better because the little girl has cancer, you bring in the dog, and this, not only does the little girl smile, but the family is now smiling. And even if just for a few minutes, they're not thinking about the awful thing that is going on. But I think, Dr. Moore, there is something going on. There's a piece that's missing that perhaps we don't even understand yet.
I think you're right. We don't understand it. We are learning more and more. And I do believe it is related to those biochemical things that change in our body when we see an animal, when we touch an animal, et cetera. I've seen it over and over again with that pony in particular, but even with others in other situations, and it's just almost magical. And I don't have an explanation for the exact mechanism.
Well, I'm going to ask you about the flying horses that you wrote about, and I'll do that. And also talk about the notion of older people adopting older animals and the pros and cons of that. We're talking with Dr. Rustin Moore, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of the Human-Animal Interaction. And we will do that when we come back on WGN. It's Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. I am not alone. Dr. Rustin Moore is here. Dr. Moore is the, let's see if I can get an A-plus here, the Rita Jean Wolf Endowed Dean, College of Veterinary Medicine at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Did I do that any better?
Oh, you got an A-plus this time.
Woohoo! From Dr. Moore. I love that. And I love what you write about in this book, because it is all about our relationship, not only with dogs and cats, but animals in general. And there's more to come, apparently, with future books, which is exciting for me to hear about. You talked in this book about, it's not only dogs and cats, you also write about, well, other species, including horses. And at one point, the flying horses and what amounts to hippotherapy or equine therapy. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, and most in this book, the thing I talk about with flying horse is there's actually a camp called Flying Horse Farms, or farm. There are no horses there. That's the name of it. But that thing in particular is they have camps, usually week-long camps, for children, youth, who have severe diseases that are really almost, require around-the-clock care from family and others. And they group them based upon the type of disease, whether it's cancer or arthritis or some musculoskeletal or heart. And basically, they come there and they are fully equipped with medical staff. It gives the parents a week of not being responsible for them, so the parents aren't there. They're fully taken care of, but they do have animals that they interact with. And the story I tell in the book is about this young boy who was really petrified of water. And because he was working with a dog, which was a corgi, and the corgi would jump into the pool, he started jumping into the deep end of the pool, and he got the name Deep End Ken. So that's the flying horse part. But yeah, in terms of equine therapy, I cover that extensively in my next book. But you know, it's a lot like a therapy dog, where you know they go in and they sort of know how they, if you take a therapy dog into a room and there's, or a hospital or whatever it be, they somehow find the person that needs them. And I heard that over and over and over again from people who have dogs that they take in for therapy. And I wondered, based on the research that we now know, if that might be they are smelling cortisol on the breath or through the skin of people who are more stressed. We know they can smell the cortisol, but there has to be a scientific explanation for why that is. And I think it could be related to the fact that they're smelling stress hormones on those people.
That is so interesting. And, you know, I add me to the list of folks, and David Fry, I don't know if you know David Fry or not. We've talked about this for a long, long time, and he's written a book about animal-assisted therapy, and he talks about that all over the country. And it is interesting that a dog can be well-trained, and the person at the other end of the leash can be a great trainer, and a dog with a solid temperament, and that dog does an adequate job, fine. May not get the A-plus from you, but does a really good job of animal-assisted therapy. But there are some dogs who excel, who, as you point out, literally walk to the person who needs them the most or the person who wants that dog the most. There are dogs that seem to intuitively know, I need, and I know this sounds so anthropomorphic, but these dogs somehow appear to understand before the directions are written by the medical professionals what this person needs. Have you heard that as well?
Oh, absolutely. And whether it's because they're stressed or because of other things, I mean, book two goes into more detail about the olfactory or the smelling capability of a dog. And I mean, whether they're detecting disease like diabetes or cancer or whatever it may be, or whether they're actually detecting tuberculosis or malaria in people, they are doing that. And there's scientific publications on this. So their ability to smell and differentiate different odors is incredible, including search and rescue dogs.
Mm-hmm.
My class veterinarian, Dr. Kim Stewart, has a black lab named Seamus, who is, I think he's about 9 now, but he has found, identified, located the remains of 10 people, many buried underground, some fully immersed in water, and others, you know, in ravines and underbrush and things like that. And, you know, and they train those dogs for one smell, and that is the smell of decomposing human flesh.
All right, let's get on to more upbeat topic, and that would be the opportunity for seniors. Most dogs in shelters and cats are seniors. Right, wrong, or otherwise, that's the way it is. What about the notion of seniors, senior humans, adopting senior pets?
I think that's a great idea, provided that they're adopting the right pet, meaning if their mobility or their balance is not good, you know, we want to make sure we don't, even though the dog might be older, isn't either too big or too small that it's going to trip them up or other things like that. But purely from an age perspective, I think it's a really great thing because sometimes people who are older are concerned that if they adopt a dog when they're later in life, that it's what's going to happen to the dog when they pass, or the cat. And the good thing is there are ways to deal with that. Pet trusts and other things, or, you know, working with your veterinarian or your family or whoever, have a plan for if that were to happen, who's going to get the animal, who's going to take care of it. And some people, like with pet trusts, provide money to help with the veterinary care and the other care of those. So I think it's a great thing. One of the, you know, we have a loneliness epidemic in this country, not that diagnosed by me, but by others. And certainly one of the things I think with older people who become isolated from other people just because they aren't out and about, that dog or that cat gives them purpose, meaning, and a reason to get out of bed every day.
Absolutely true. And there's so much more that we just don't have time for in the book. This book. There's another one coming. We learned that. You know what the next one's going to be called?
I do. The next one is already in copy editing, and it's called Unlocking the Bond. The power and paradox of human-animal interactions.
Ooh, that sounds good. This is called, the one I'm talking about now, the one you can get now, is called Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions. Dr. Rustin Moore, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. And we will do it again when the next book comes out.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. And you know, the book is now available in four formats on Amazon: ebook, paperback, hardback. And just yesterday, it's now on there as a audiobook.
Perfect. You will find it no matter how you want to find it. Unleashing the Bond. Thank you, Dr. Moore. Next week on the show, we will be speaking with the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Michael Bailey. And I'll tell you, there's a lot to unpack, a lot to talk about. I want to talk about a question that I'm often asked about, and I think it's a fair question, and that is access to care, the affordability of veterinary care. And we'll see what he says about that. But you know what? This is a huge problem, and one of the reasons to date why too many pets are being given up to shelters. It is, I can't afford the care anymore, as people now have more often than ever before, two or three pets. We'll also talk about pets and autism. Is it possible for our pets, our dogs and cats, to actually be on the spectrum? And virtual care, is that a good thing? Is it not a good thing? All of that with Dr. Michael Bailey next week. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.